Okay, I think we're ready to begin. Hi, everybody, and welcome. I'm Ryan Jones from CMJ. This is the webcasting carp panel called Rotten from the Head Down or Fresh Fish Special. Just got a couple of quick announcements, and we'll get underway here. First, please turn off your cell phone, ringers, whatever. If you have a conversation you need to have, please take it to the hallway. Photography is also not allowed in this room. And now I would like to introduce our moderator, Michael Papish, sitting here in the middle of our table. He's the CEO of Media Unbound. He got his start as a chief engineer for Harvard's radio station, WHRB, helped put them on the net when webcasting was just a glimmer in John Simpson's eye. A computer consulting biz, he began while still a student. It became Media Unbound. It's a technology company that developed the recommendation engine used by PressPlay. Michael also testified earlier this year at the Copyright Office hearings and co-authored the joint legal challenge to the CARP decision, followed by WHRB and the Intercollegiate Broadcast System. They don't get more expert than this, folks. Please welcome Michael Papish.
Thank you, Ryan, and hello. I guess this is one of the first CMJ panels of the couple days here, and I think it's going to be a great one. Kevin Duran and the panel people here put together a really excellent group of people representing all different parts of the webcasting industry. And the picture we just took together, I think you should remember that we're all smiling and friends for afterwards when maybe there are chairs and other things that are flying around the room. To give you an idea of webcasting and what we're going to talk about, it's a very complicated issue, something which has multiple sides, many more than just record labels and artists on one side and webcasters on the other side. And so we're going to try to delve into some of the complexities and some of the interesting things about it over the next hour and a half or so. The real reason, I guess, why we're here is a question of how much money webcasters have to pay to copyright owners to use music. And as you might be aware, there's a big difference between traditionally where radio stations only pay royalties to the composers of music, not to the performers of music. And in 1978, there was a report by the Register of Copyrights, which advocated starting a right for sound performances. And what we see here today is really the outcome of what started in 1978 and has been applied to the digital world. Royalties to the performers of music. And that includes record labels, which own the copyrights, and artists, which are the ones performing the works. And the CARP, which is really, I guess, the subject of our panel today, was the Copyright Arbitration Royalty Panel, which was set up to determine what the rate would be to pay these people for webcasters. And it started in the year 2000 and went on for 2 years, and came out with a rate which many people had, I guess, problems with on all sides. And most recently, there's been legislation in the House and the Senate to talk about this, and there are many ongoing debates and discussions, and we're hoping to get into some of them today. What I'd like to do is first introduce the panelists and sort of ask them a question, and then we'll open up for some more discussion, and then we'll reserve the last 20 minutes or so for a question and answer period from the audience, which I think should be terrific. First, I'd like to introduce Danny Goldberg over there. Danny Goldberg is currently the chairman and CEO of Artemis Records. Artemis features a wide range of artists, from Steve Earle to the Baha Men to Boston. Billboard magazine named Artemis Records the number one independently distributed record label of the year for 2 years in a row, 2000 and 2001. Previously, Danny was the chairman and CEO of Mercury Records Group, president of Mercury Records, the chairman and CEO of Warner Brothers Records, and the president of Atlantic Records. So I guess we'll just consider him the CEO of the music industry. So I guess a question that I wanted to ask was, in August, Artemis and Danny announced that all records and all sound recordings from Artemis would be able to be played on internet radio royalty-free for a full year. And I was wondering if you explained the reasoning behind why you made that agreement available, and what you think the promotional value of music on internet radio is?
Well, I just was reading the articles after the bill passed describing the pressure that it put on internet radio financially, and as somebody who started a new business myself a couple of years ago, it ran true to me that it would be too burdensome. I don't think anybody knows in the future what the economics of the music business are going to be. It's all of the people that a couple of years ago said they were prophets turned out to be wrong, but there's no question that there's dramatic and radical change happening. So I think it's appropriate for the companies to try to set some precedents. I think Jesse Helms has it exactly wrong. What a surprise. Usually I agree with about everything. But it's rare instance he's wrong. And I noticed that he held up the implementation of a bill that would have lowered the fees. So I just want to correct one thing you said, where you said that radio stations have not paid record companies in the past, traditional, analog radio stations. That's only true in the United States. In the rest of the world, radio stations pay both the songwriters and the owners of the songs and record companies and the performances. And our country has been sort of a bit of a freak. Again, a very surprising thing. We usually harmonize so well with the rest of the world. But, and it's to me, it never made any sense why the songwriters would make money and the singers, and the people who invest in the recordings wouldn't. So I think you don't, just because one bad thing happened, you don't do two bad things. So I think the consciousness behind the bill was correct, but what happens with record companies at the big level where I used to work is that the lawyers make all the decisions. And I used to say, I've used this line in other conferences, which is, that's kind of like having a hockey team of all goalies, because you have a very defensive, paranoid, worst-case scenario mentality driving the agenda of an entire company and ignoring things like marketing and promotion, which are equally important. I don't think that you want to eliminate lawyers. You need to protect yourself, but you can't have lawyers making every single decision because you would never do promotion. And it seemed like a no-brainer to me at a time when internet radio was not making a lot of money and many of the stations were struggling to just pay their bills, that it would be good for us and for the artists on our label to have exposure. We don't know exactly what internet radio does in terms of selling records, but it can't be a bad thing. The whole strategy of marketing music has always been to let people hear some of it for free and then hoping that the audience falls in love with the artist enough to want to buy the official product, and that a lot of internet stations play genres of music that are not easily available on commercial radio. And a lot of our artists are in that category, people like Warren Zevon and Steve, who you mentioned, and others. So I thought that without wanting to mortgage our entire future to a press release, that 1 year was a safe statement to make. I wanted to make a statement of respect and appreciation for internet radio as an alternative, and to give at least that year window, and we'll do it year by year as the economics unfold. But right now, the promotional value to our artists far outweighs any possible revenue that we would get, and that's why we did it. Plus, it got us good press.
Excellent. And we're going to get into a lot more of those issues as we go on. Next, I'd like to introduce Ken Friedman. Ken Friedman is the general manager of the non-commercial WFMU, based in Jersey City, the country's longest-running and most renowned freeform radio station. Some consider it the birthplace of freeform radio with Vince Delsa during the 1960s. The station's been named the best radio station in the U.S. by Rolling Stone for 4 years in a row, even received extremely high praise from Simpsons creator Matt Groening, and has a really amazing website where they not only have a live stream of their radio station, they also have archives of all their programming. It's really phenomenal. And so a question for Ken. We talked earlier, and Ken had mentioned that webcasting is really sort of the highest, both short-term and long-term priority for WFMU. And so, with a lot of the costs associated with webcasting, both from the bandwidth side and from the royalty side, I was wondering, why that is. Why does FMU consider this such an important medium for now and for the future?
Well, webcasting is important to us. We became independent of our college. We used to belong to Uppsala College, and the college went belly up in 1994, and we somehow survived. We were the only part of the college to survive and become independent, but we almost went bankrupt in the process. What saved the station really was the audience growth that we've experienced from webcasting. I think webcasting makes up for a lot of the deficiencies that we experience with the FCC. Most of the radio stations here at CMJ are between 88 and 92 FM, and the FCC doesn't take very good care of non-commercial college community radio stations. They allow them to interfere with each other much more than commercial stations. College community radio stations are really taken advantage of by larger public radio stations, by religious radio stations. That doesn't happen like that on the commercial dial. For my station, being in the New York area, we've really had to fight to keep our coverage, and our coverage is about half of what it was 20 years ago. Webcasting makes up for that. It's a totally different model of broadcasting where anybody can get on the air. You don't need a license. If I start a web radio station in my room and you have one in your room, we don't interfere with each other. It's a much smarter model of broadcasting than the current analog broadcasting model, and I hope that webcasting will become the model for future models of broadcasting over the air, where one radio station doesn't have to interfere with another one. We overcame a lot of problems with webcasting, mostly the bandwidth, and when this issue came up, we tried in every possible way that we could to get involved in the decision-making process of what the royalties would be. But I found that and I think a lot of people have found, that there's a whole class of radio stations, college, community, and religious radio stations, that have pretty much been left out of the decision-making process. And it's led to a basic unfairness in how these royalties have been derived and what the effect is going to be on non-commercial radio stations. Even the FCC, which really doesn't take care of community radio stations, has a set-aside, 88 to 92 FM, what's known as the reserve band, for non-commercial radio stations. I think that webcasting should also have a special rate for non-commercial broadcasters on the web. I'd like to thank Danny for taking the step of offering waivers for webcasters who use Artemis Records artists. We've taken advantage of that for the first year. We've also tried to negotiate our own rates with 300 other independent record labels, and we have found that 300 labels, so far we've asked 1,500 labels, 300 of them have agreed to waive webcasting royalties for us. I wish it wasn't necessary to do that. I wish that there had been a way that non-commercial broadcasters, meaning college radio stations, community broadcasters, and religious broadcasters, which is what brought Jesse Helms into this whole issue, talk about strange bedfellows, that there was a way for those people to also take advantage of a fair rate and not be scared off. I find that the basic rate, the whole structure that's been negotiating, tends to penalize success. And I think that's true for the smallest radio stations, and it's true for the largest webcasters. The more successful you are, the more you're going to have to pay. It would have been a terrible thing if that same structure had been applied to the AM band during its development, during the FM band during its development, or during television. Webcasting is another spectrum, just as important as AM, FM, and television were in their day, and I don't think that success should be penalized on this band. Before this panel began, we had talks with John Simpson, and I was heartened to hear that he does feel that there is room for a non-commercial rate, but I would urge him to include us and to get the information out there so that we can be involved in the decision-making process and we don't lead to a fiasco like what just happened with Jesse Helms, who in defending religious broadcasters held up what could have been a positive bill, the Small Webcasters Amendment Act. It just so happens that the religious broadcasters that Jesse Helms was defending are in the same boat as a lot of you are here. College, community, and religious broadcasters have pretty much been left out of the decision-making process, and I hope going forward we can change that.
Excellent. And speaking of John Simpson, John's down at that end. John is the executive director of Sound Exchange, and Sound Exchange is currently an unincorporated division of the RIAA, and they're tasked with distributing the royalties both from webcasting and other sound performances, and distributing those to both the labels and to artists. He's been involved in the music industry since 1971, when he was originally a singer and songwriter with Perception Records. In between, he managed Mary Chapin Carpenter, Jonell Mosser, and others. He's practiced entertainment law since 1980, and is currently an adjunct professor of entertainment law at American University's Washington College of Law. And so, John, in a recent filing with the Copyright Office over the record-keeping ideas, Sound Exchange has stated that there was basically insufficient data from the retroactive period, the last 4 years of webcasting, to really distribute any of these royalties. And so my question to you is, when is Sound Exchange course going to distribute royalties, and how is this going to be based, and when are you going to start distributing this money?
At Sound Exchange, our job obviously is to distribute the royalties we collect as accurately as possible. I think one of the reasons college radio, non-commercial radio, presents
such a dilemma for us is, on the one hand, we recognize your record keeping or your automation is far less than the larger commercial services. On the other hand, you're playing far more interesting music, and we want to make sure that the artists you're playing are the ones getting paid. We've seen in our initial distribution of satellite royalties, which we did in October of last year, this was 5 years of historic royalties collected from February 1 of 96, when the first digital performance rights took place, through March of 2000, 85 million distinct sound recordings. We matched those through a database to about 700,000 distinct recordings. And we were doing this on a census basis, so if anyone was getting played, they were getting paid. We were not doing a sampling model the way some of the other PROs do, because we're in a digital world and because we're in a much more diverse world. Even these satellite services with many, many different channels, only maybe 50 channels or 100 channels of programming, we had 20,000 artists, thousands of labels, and we've been out finding those artists and labels. So it's a massive task for us to try to distribute accurately. Michael's comments on the webcasting side for this historical period, October of 98 through 2002, how are we going to do this? If we can't get data, we're going to have to find some sort of a proxy. For college radio, maybe it's BMI has surveyed 50,000 hours of college radio a year. Maybe we have to look at that for college radio. We have to find, essentially, another way to get that data if you guys don't have it. Let me say a couple of things that have been mentioned. People are unhappy with the rates. You know, we've seen some obvious instances of direct licensing. What you have to remember is compulsory license. That's what was said here. You know, in exchange for getting a performance right, the right to get paid when your songs are being performed for artists and labels. The quid pro quo for that, the exchange was a compulsory license. No artist can opt out of this. An artist can't say, oh, I don't want my songs webcast. They don't have the choice. No label can say that. So you have the absolute right to webcast anything that's released and protected under U.S. copyright law. You can get other kinds of licenses. The compulsory license is the easy license because you go to one place, you come to Sound Exchange, we take care of all the work. We find all the hundreds of labels and thousands of artists that have to get paid. You pay us, it's one-stop shopping, and of course, the cost of our finding these people comes out of our rights owners, our artists' share. It doesn't come out of your, you're not paying us extra to do that. If we didn't exist, you'd have to go out and find every single one of those labels, every single one of those artists. Kind of like the exercise that Ken undertook. You know, it may be more work to do 300 direct licenses to get a lower rate or a free rate while webcasting's in its infancy. And certainly one can argue that, you know, for a station like that, it's worthwhile. You know, Danny said he was doing it because he wanted to see the marketplace develop. You know, my sense was AOL, MTV, Viacom, they can afford it now. There's no reason why they need a pass. You know, we are in a developing marketplace, but, you know, artists and labels, most of my labels are small businesses too, very small businesses. Sound Exchange represents about 400 independent labels, about 2,000 artists right now, and it's, again, a growing field and a field that they're very interested in because it is, performance rights are an important income stream around the rest of the world, and they need to become an important stream in the United States. Just, Danny sort of referred to it in Europe. Every year in Europe, they collect performance royalties from radio play and television play. The estimates are that a couple hundred million dollars of that are collected for U.S. recordings, for U.S. artists. They look over to the United States and they say, hey, you're not a signatory to the Rome Convention. You don't have a reciprocal right. We're keeping the money here in the U.K., in Holland, in France, wherever. We lose, our artists lose, $200 million somewhere around that neighborhood dollars a year for us not having that right for terrestrial radio and television. So this is a first step to correct that. You know, I lobbied for this law as a manager representing artists. I thought it was very important that we get established in a new technology that the rules be set right, that we not repeat the inequity of the past where the broadcasters essentially beat us up. Every time there was a new copyright act, there would be a statute saying there should be a performance right every time the broadcasters made it down.
Okay. So we'll get into all that stuff. There's a lot of stuff. Talking about direct licenses, over here we have David Goldberg. David is the Vice President and General Manager of Music at Yahoo. Prior to that, he was the co-founder and CEO of Launch, which was acquired by Yahoo in August of 2001. Launch, and by definition Yahoo, is currently the web's number one music destination, as rated by Nielsen Net Ratings in September, and has a large selection of music videos, exclusive artist features, and music news covering all different genres of music. And prior to working at Launch, David was the Director of Marketing Strategy and New Business Development at Capitol Records. I guess talking about direct licensing, while you weren't at Yahoo at the time, most of the decision by the CARP was based on a deal that Yahoo had ended up signing with the RAAA. And actually, Mark Cuban, who is in charge of Broadcast.com, ended up negotiating that. And so my question is, because that rate was so pivotal to the CARP, how much does that really impact your business today? Is it still a good deal for Yahoo on today's market?
Well, as you said, I wasn't there when the deal was done. The deal was done for specific reasons at the time, which made sense at the time, but the world has changed. Yahoo's business has changed. Yahoo didn't have a substantial music business. It was mostly a retransmission of terrestrial radio stations at the time. And now that I'm responsible for all of these businesses inside of Yahoo, clearly our outlook on this original deal and going forward has changed pretty dramatically. We now are working with all the other webcasters. We will not do another deal like this going forward, but instead work with everybody together to get the best deal. We think that the rate that was established by the librarian is significantly too high. When you do the math, it works out to, for terrestrial radio, if they had to pay the same rate, it works out to over $1 billion a year in royalties to the record companies. So that's more than the combined profits of all of the record companies in the U.S. So, it's very clear that there was a lot of problems and issues. I think everyone on all sides agrees that the whole process itself is also broken. It needs to get fixed. And I think there's some very good conversations and dialogues going on among all the parties to fix the process. But I think that we need to sort of, there's a whole range of issues with webcasting, the rate, who's eligible, all these sort of things are only one piece of a larger set of issues. And I think that Danny said it best. I mean, I think this stuff has to get out of the world of the lawyers only at the record companies, and it has to sort of be looked at in the context of the entire music business. And I think as we start to get bigger, and I mean we collectively as the webcasting business, we can help influence that. So, we really applaud what Danny has done. We have gone out of our way to do extra promotion for Artemis artists. We are working with other artists who are...
What exactly?
What? And we have. We've worked with your team to actually do promotions specifically around your music.
A little more would be appreciated.
I'm actually coming over tomorrow to talk to some... I'm coming tomorrow to talk about some other things we're going to do. So, I think as an industry, we need to go out and support those artists and those labels that are willing to do this. And I think on the same token, we need to be willing to say to some artists and some labels that are particularly the problem, hey, you guys are non with the program, why should we help you sell records when you're trying to shut down or, restrict our businesses? And so I think, the clout hasn't been there. That's why we got sort of walked over when the law was passed originally. And the CARP statute was revised, and it was this willing buyer, willing seller thing was inserted in. I think that as we gain as an industry in terms of value on the promotional side, artists and labels can make that choice and say, we want the promotion, we want the access. And I think that, the truth is that, we're probably the largest webcaster right now, and I still don't think we have the ability to take an unknown artist and break them.
but I think in a year from now, we will, and I think working together, I think that that opportunity exists. That will make the labels sort of look at it from a different perspective.
Okay, great, and let's just get to Kurt before we open up for everyone. Kurt is the publisher of RAIN, a radio internet newsletter, and it's actually updated daily and many times more than daily as news breaks and announces about issues pertaining to internet radio. Before RAIN, Kurt was the co-founder of Strategic Media Research, a market research firm, and pioneered the concept of call-out music research. Before then, he worked at radio stations, specifically WOKY in Milwaukee, WLS in Chicago, WDAI in Chicago, and WLUP in Chicago. And so my question to Kurt and his folks at RAIN follow sort of the small commercial webcasters really closely in addition to the rest of the industry. And on their site, they list about 150 to 200 radio stations that have gone out of business or stopped streaming because of fears about the royalty rates. And so my question was, how many of these were shut down because they couldn't afford the royalties versus how many shut down really just because they weren't businesses that were operating at a profit or being able to make ends meet at the end of each month?
There are some webcasters that were successful. Well, all small commercial webcasters are in trouble. If you didn't have under the terms that the Librarian of Congress set at the royalty rate, that rate is, as you may know, 0.07 cents per song per listener. So if you had a few hundred listeners in the course of the average moment during the middle of the day, and you had that going on for a couple of years, you may be liable to this retroactive obligation at that rate for the whole period gone back as far back as October 1998. Could be tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars, which is, you know, very reasonable, which is chump change, I imagine, in the world of AOL or Microsoft, their webcasting. But if you're doing this out of a garage, that's deadly. When record labels were trying to do these deals with webcasters a couple of years ago to establish a willing buyer, willing seller record for the car that they knew was coming, they started out in some of the early deals asking for 15% of revenues. Well, this 0.07 cents per song per listener, for somebody like Soma FM, for example, or Radio Paradise, or somebody like that, it works out to 300 or 400% of the revenues, which would bankrupt anyone, unless if you're a division of a conglomerate. So all of these smaller webcasters face this problem. And very few of them have shut down because most of them are hoping that there will be either a settlement. There's several different options. There's a judicial. There may be some judicial response, there's some lawsuits being filed, there may be a legislative response, like we all almost got a couple weeks ago, Jesse Helms had interfered. There could be a negotiated settlement that when Jesse scotched that deal, their Sound Exchange was generously willing to offer the same terms, at least tentatively.
Yeah, and we'll definitely try to get to those too.
I'm going on and on about what your answer. The answer is most of them, many of them shut down foolish, that they only had a few listeners at the average moment. Their total obligation will be only $500 a year under the most odious terms that Library and Congress set. On the other hand, many of them are broadcasters who have been broadcasters who have stations that people would like to listen to. Those should not have been shut down. It's a it's probably lawyers getting in the way. So a mix of it, there are only a few that would be really good quality commercial webcasters that you or I might think had real quality and diversity, okay. But they are important.
Thank you. All right, so now that we've determined that lawyers are the root of all the problems here, if you were in charge of the CARP, what would you say to the rate? What's a fair rate? What do you want to pay that would both respect the copyright owners but also let you as a service survive and webcast in a flourishing market? And I'll open that up to anyone who wants to jump in.
I'll start very briefly just with context. Composers in the U.S. on the broadcast side and on the internet side, composers combined, the ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC rate adds up to about 3% of revenues. In other countries that are signatories to copyright rights or copyright stuff, Composers get roughly 3-4% of revenues, and the performers and labels get roughly 3-4% of revenues in most countries.
So you're advocating a similarity between what we currently pay for terrestrial and what we'd be paying?
I think that's a starting point for the conversation, and then we can discuss whether internet radio ought to be higher or lower than that.
John, I mean, what would you think about saying that the price of a sound recording is the same as that of a sound composition? Do you think they're equal? Do you think they should be different?
No, I think having worked in this industry both as a recording artist, as a manager, I'm a recovering manager, much like Danny. I think we see that far more money is invested in sound recording and in the promotional work that an artist does to promote a recording than is done to promote a work. And I think the other aspect of that as well is that once a sound recording, typically a record company breaks a song. I mean, it starts with a great song, but a record company invests in breaking a song. That song, once it's an evergreen or, you know, it's a popular song, will come back again and again. So the music publisher and the writer may have multiple chances, whereas the label and the artist have that one record. I mean, maybe it'll be a live version of the greatest hits later on, but essentially they've got one shot, whereas the song itself has many shots. And, you know, and I think there's, so I think a differential is justified. If I could also comment, you know, Stephen's comment about $1 billion, well, $1 billion is what radio pays to ASCAP and BMI for the songwriters and music publishers. So, you know, if radio paid us $1 billion, that'd be great.
I mean, Danny, I mean, opening up your catalog, I guess, almost for free, for promotional value, obviously you said you do respect the value of sound recordings. You know, where do you see the value? I mean, radio pays nothing right now, and obviously, you know, you've said that there is promotional value in internet radio, so what kind of rates would you think are fair?
You know, as an indie label, I'm not trying to be a philosopher king about this stuff, and I haven't looked at it at this time in my career the way the other people on the panel have. I'm trying to break one artist at a time and trying to do what's right short term. I think long term, the approach of sound exchange is one that I probably agree with. I just think that the nuance is that these things are black and white issues, and that the way this is going to work is to have, you know, within, is to not only have the discussions be about what the legal rate is. There's all sorts of rates that are negotiated all the time. There's a statutory rate on copyrights and now, and yet on a new artist, sometimes you'll negotiate a 3/4 rate because of the greater cost of breaking an artist. There's discounts given on retail prices. There's all different kinds of things that people do, and I think that there's been a lot of hubris on all sides of this at the big company level. The record companies are the favorite, the whipping boys, and I don't have any great love for these big companies. They all fired me when I had these great jobs we mentioned before, so, you know, it's not like I have any great sentimental attachment to any of them. But, and now, you know, there are competitors, but the fact is that there was an enormous amount of hubris in the internet world over the last decade of people who were just starting companies completely ignoring the concept of copyrights or any payment at all. People who would make speeches saying music should be free and, you know, this sort of a thing.
Is anyone on this panel saying that that's not
free? Yeah, I always felt if anything was going to be free, it should be food. You know, and if people would start making food free, maybe we'd start making music free. But I think that the approach is correct, but what's lacking is the nuances of the tremendous difference between a big company, a small company, and a non-commercial company. The difference between a short-term reality and a long-term reality. That's why I said Jesse Helms got it wrong. He said that he wants to give up the short-term savings because he doesn't want to set the long-term precedent. I'm exactly the opposite. I like the long-term precedent, but I think short-term, record companies and copyright owners have to be rational about not damaging businesses that would help our business.
I mean, so Ken, operating a non-commercial community station, very similar to many people in attendance in the stations they run, what is the long-term, I mean, what are the long-term prospects you outlined before that you saw the internet and internet radio as an important, extremely important to your station? You know, how do you balance that long-term goals? Are you looking for rates that are going to let you flourish in the future? Are you looking for ways to continue webcasting today? What kind of rates are fair for you?
we're looking for rates that wouldn't prevent us from investing in the growth of our online audience. We're looking for rates that would not penalize us for being successful. I think there's a basic difference between a college or community broadcaster of a web or a FM radio station than the commercial counterpart. If you operate a commercial radio station, whether it's FM or webcasting, if you make it successful, you personally share in its success. You have equity in the company, you might get a bonus, you might get equity, your share prices might go up. That's not true of college or community radio stations, so I really don't accept the notion that college or community radio stations should have to pay the more listeners they have. I think for college stations, there should be a small annual rate, maybe $100, $200 a year. Right now, the rate is $500 a year. If you average more than what I was told is 17 and a half listeners per hour over a 24-hour period throughout the year, you have to start paying over $500 a year. It really doesn't make sense to me to be applying the same notion of paying per song, per listener, to not-for-profit community and college radio stations as to their commercial counterparts. It just doesn't make any sense at all.
So I'd ask the question to David. How does that jive with Yahoo's feeling? I mean, are you willing to see smaller stations have lower royalty rates?
I think you have to differentiate, as Ken said, between non-commercial and commercial. I think, you know, and I'm not the expert on non-commercial, but I don't really see the argument of, you know, trying to extract large sums of money from non-commercial webcasters. I just don't see the point of it from anybody's standpoint. On the small commercial webcasters, though, I think actually what it sounds like a really nice thing in theory to say, well, small commercial webcasters can pay less because they can't afford it, but big ones can afford more. But the truth is, nobody's making money in this space. And I work for a big company, but I started my own company and ran it as a small company. We grew into being a larger company and were acquired by a bigger company. But the truth is no one can build a business small or large if the rates don't work. And if you are a small one and you grow into being a big one and all of a sudden those rates become untenable, which is what some of the sort of mid-range people have found in the deal that was cut and the bill that was stopped, it's sort of like it protected a certain class of small webcasters, but it didn't protect people, you know, on the really low end. It didn't protect people in the next thing. You can't differentiate. We have a problem. This rate and the structure and all these things don't work. And just trying to solve it for one small class of that, you're just pushing the problem around. So I do think there's a big difference between small commercial webcasters and non-commercial webcasters and what the rate. I think the rate is too high for everybody. I don't think it's too high just for small commercial webcasters. I think that my take on the rates is frankly that I think we should, as an industry, you know, the logic is just completely wrong. Record labels spend $200 million a year to bribe terrestrial radio stations to play their music. It's called independent promotion. It's not very effective because everybody's paying, and so therefore it doesn't really work very well.
Some people would say that radio stations extort $200 million a year from record companies. Otherwise, they won't play their music. I don't really think we're going to all get all weepy about some of the big radio companies and their terrible problems.
I'm not suggesting we are, and I'm just saying that there's clearly a lot of value to new music being played, whether it's on terrestrial radio or internet radio. And I think, on the other hand, I think there's tremendous value to radio, and whether that be webcasters or terrestrial radio, of the catalog. And so if you look at a way a record company works, they're really focused on selling a new release, whether that be from a new artist or a major superstar artist, and that's why they're willing to pay money to get radio to play that song, and that's why they're willing to do promotions and all those sort of things. I think, on the other hand, there's a lot more value accrued to the broadcaster, whoever they are, for those catalog, and there's a lot less value accrued, and so I actually think you could look at the bifurcating the rates in terms of, you know, there should be a essentially a higher rate for the catalog stuff and a lower rate for the newer music, and that really reflects the economic realities of where the value creation is, because it's clearly very valuable to the artists and labels to get their new songs played, or they wouldn't be doing as much as they're doing, and there's clearly a lot of value to terrestrial radio, and really at that point, after you've created a big hit song, you really want people to go buy the record in the store. You don't necessarily care whether they hear it on the radio or not. So to me, that makes a lot of sense.
Is there a difference between internet radio and terrestrial radio, over the air radio? I mean, why do we treat them differently?
Well, first of all, I think terrestrial radio should be paying performance fees. So I think that part, we start there. But yes, there is a difference, a very big difference. For example, when managing artists, if you got an ad in a particular station, you're getting a lot of rotations in a particular city, and you knew that you were getting played in that city, a promoter in that city would call you and say, okay, let's come to a show, and you'd go to make sure that your merchandise people and your people at the label, marketing people, had all of the handicaps and the pricing and positioning and the ads in the local papers. You'd want to have all that stuff done so that you were promoted because you knew you were getting played in front of a million people or whatever the audience of that station was in that marketplace. I don't think on internet radio you can say that. You have a much more dislodged.
Why?
Because you're broadcasting to people everywhere, not to one particular market.
But I'm broadcasting to a lot of people in a lot of markets. And I reach as many people in certain markets as the terrestrial radio station does. So what's the difference?
It's set up very differently. And well,
and I'm doing promotions with retail, so we tie into the retailer. We have end caps at Target that we put product in.
Thing that makes you better than radio, why I like rather listen to you than radio, is that you're not playing the same songs, 20 songs over and
we're not allowed to.
And over. Yeah, you can play.
I'm not saying we would, because I don't think our listeners want to, but even if we wanted to, we couldn't. If you're telling me that's the difference, then great, let me play more songs more frequently.
I think that's what makes radio more promotional and webcasting less promotional. And frankly,
that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. You created a law which says we're not allowed to do that, and then you're saying that's the reason we should have to pay. It's like...
No, I'm not saying that you should pay because it's the right thing to do. It's the right thing to do to have performance rights.
But you should
pay. I'm not saying I shouldn't pay.
Listen, the answer, first of all, is that it's wrong that terrestrial radio doesn't pay in the United States.
Agreed.
They pay everywhere else in the world.
I'm not disagreeing with that.
And you don't replicate bad precedents, you replicate good precedents. The good precedent is what happens in the rest of the world and what happens with songwriters. I think your formulation, I agree with your idea about maybe creating a distinction between new music and old music. I think that gets at some underlying economic truth. I'm not a lawyer or an accountant. I don't know, it would be so easy to come up with those forms, but I think there's a truth to that that's undeniable. I think that when you get out of formulas and rates and lawyers and all these things, you get into the guts of actually trying to make something work. You've got to understand that the record business is in a free fall right now. Whether it's just the nature of the cycles of technology and the economy, or whether it's because there are a bunch of people who are idiots, I don't know. But there are a lot of idiots in the internet world, that's for sure. So it's not only the record company that has had idiots.
There are idiots everywhere.
What's true is that record company model is under assault. Record companies are closing left and right around the world. People are getting laid off left and right around the world. So the margins of record companies are under assault. Yet, record companies are still the only place in the society, anywhere in the world, that invests in artists and that invests in marketing and creating new stars, which many other businesses then benefit from, whether it's magazines that put people on the covers, TV that puts them on, and all that sort of a thing. But you can't address these things without recognizing the dilemma of record companies. And at the same time, record companies can't address these things without recognizing, you know, that there has to be reasonable profits growth and, you know, arc of creation of these new businesses.
So are we seeing a shift? I mean, is one of the reasons why we're here today, we're seeing a shift in the record industry from selling what was, you know, vinyl or CDs to something that's more of a service, like internet radio or like an on-demand service? I mean, WFMU has got a gigantic record sale going on this week. Are we seeing people not buying records and we're seeing this as a way to replace it? Is that true or not?
Well, listen, Best Buy sold 85 million which is the biggest retailer of pre-recorded music in the country, sold 85 million pre-recorded CDs, conventional CDs last year, and over 300 million blank CDs during the same year period. That's a fact. So that's not so great for the record business or for the artists who have counted on that as part of their revenue. So, of course, record companies are trying to figure out, okay, MTV is worth $1 zillion. They started playing videos that we all financed and gave them for free with VJs that, no disrespect to Martha Quinn and anything, but I think people were probably tuning in to see Michael Jackson and Madonna more than her and Mark Goodman and the other original MTV VJs. So, you know, everybody's thinking, hey, you know, we better figure out some methodology of getting some return. And it's a very, it's like groping in the dark. Nobody knows what is the future economic model. No one knows what's fair. And it's the nature of all these companies are such that it's not so easy to create legal conversations to really figure out how to solve each other's problems.
So is Ken and WFMU, are you stuck in the middle of this dialogue?
They're going to be fine. Everybody likes WFMU. when he's right, everybody's going to agree and he's going to get what he wants. They're more complex negotiations with the Yahoos of the world.
I think that I'm in the same boat as the Yahoos of the world, and that my success is penalized. And the only people whose success is not penalized in the webcasting industry are those webcasters who have a direct tie-in to a giant conglomerate, such as AOL Time Warner. What did AOL have to pay Time Warner to use its own catalog? Nothing. So what's happening is the five largest music conglomerates are attempting to control webcasting as a spectrum. They're not trying to extract fair payment. I don't think anybody has any problem with fair payment. They're trying to control the spectrum and penalize anybody else's growth other than the five largest record conglomerates.
If you think that first of all, I'm not and will not be part of any of those record conglomerates. Secondly, if you think the people at AOL care anything about the feelings of the people at Warner Music or vice versa, you don't understand the nature of the politics of that corporation.
But what do they have to pay to license their own catalog?
I don't know, but they have different agendas.
I would doubt they have to pay very much to license their own catalog.
I would think that you would get what you want a lot better if you focused on the virtue of non-commercial rate. I think that rhetoric is very attractive to people like me. I would stick with that and not team up with the Yahoos of the world, you know, in this argument, because I think that you are a unique treasure and entities like yours and the record companies, I don't think would have any problem distinguishing between non-commercial and commercial ventures.
Well, that may be true, but I also see webcasting as a new spectrum, the same as AM was, FM was, and television was.
It is.
And it shouldn't be controlled by these giant conglomerates.
Well, you know what? If I invest hundreds of thousands of dollars in an artist, why should someone else not have to pay the art, and the artist goes out and does all this work, why should someone else be able to take that and build some other business out of it for free?
We're not talking about for free. Fair payment is one thing, but driving people out of the business and off the space is another thing.
I agree with you. That's why I'm making our music available for free right now, because the economy of these new companies can't afford it. But the idea that there's no long-term appropriateness of having a rate so that when these things become multi-billion dollar entities the way MTV is today, that it doesn't drive the record companies are going out of business too. Everybody's going out of business right now. Let's not kill each other. Let's figure out how to rationally understand these issues and make incremental distinctions such as you made between non-commercial and commercial, as opposed to having bombastic rhetoric and people like Jesse Helms driving.
So how
guarantee will get us nowhere.
How do we do that? I mean, the CARP, which we all know is somewhat flawed. It makes it very difficult for small entities to participate because the costs are extremely high. And before we were talking about ways of doing it, we really couldn't come up with any terrific examples of how the CARP could be made extremely fair for everyone. Does anyone have any ideas?
Well, you did start the copyright royalty tribunal all over again.
And so could you explain how that works for people?
Well, I'm not an expert on it because it was before my time, but there used to be a tribunal that said, you know, that these were government employees, and you went there and you presented your case, and so you weren't paying. The government was paying, essentially. Now, the parties are having to pay these arbitrators, and if it's a six-month arbitration, it's expensive. You know, I mentioned earlier there's no reason why GEMA, who represents the bigger webcasters, could not have included smaller services. You know, they could. Why didn't they extend that? Hey, we'd like to have the non-commercials as part of our mix so that the whole range of webcasters are represented. GEMA had the opportunity to do that.
Right. So GEMA is the Digital Media Association,
who represents a larger player.
So, Kurt, I mean, looking at the small commercial webcasters, do they have the same agendas as some of the larger ones? Is there a rift between GEMA and the small webcasters?
Yeah, there is to some extent. Probably from my perspective, I think there have to be different rates for different business models. In the case of the small commercial webcaster, of the 0.07 cents, which, you know, since there's no national advertising market yet from Connect Radio, a rate that's 300 or 400% of revenues is a bankruptcy rate, and a percentage of revenues makes perfect sense for them. For the AOL Musics of the world, a flat fee, like, I'm not sure 0.07 cents is correct, but a flat fee makes sense.
It goes for higher, I think, AOL.
You know, the advertising on Spinner is part of a bundled advertising package, and the listening on AOL radio is partly paid for by the subscription to AOL, and it would probably be a nightmare for them to try and figure out exactly what the revenues are attributable to radio at AOL, and thus, if you can't figure it out, because it's all, well, what percentage of the ad sale was radio versus the homepage mention, versus the subscription fee, et cetera, a flat fee makes it much easier for them, or a flat fee option, I think, makes it much easier for them. I would think
the derivation, if I could just jump in, of the performance rate came from the users. It was the larger services that wanted this. It came, if you think about the way radios developed, ASCAP and BMI have always had blanket licenses. You pay us X percent of your revenue for our entire catalog. Well, TV stations came along, some radio programmers came along and said, we don't want to pay for your whole catalog, we want to pay just for what we use. And ASCAP and BMI did not want to do that, and they were forced by rate courts and consent decrees to do it. So they started offering program licenses. In the webcasting world, these large services, we want that. We want to pay as we go. We don't want to pay a percentage of revenue, largely for Kirk's points, that it was too difficult for them to figure it out. I think there were some people uncomfortable with a percentage of revenue because there wasn't very much revenue, so it was essentially giving it away for free, and also penalized, I think people love to penalize people who were more successful. If I use the same amount of music but make more money, why should I pay more than you who use the same amount of music as I do but make less money? So I think there were some those kinds of threads that went through the car. Now, there is a differential rate for non-commercial stations. You should all know that. I mean, the minimum is the same for everybody, but the rate is different. I don't know that we've made that very clear.
Right, but it's still a per performance,
it's still
not
performance
a percentage of revenue. So I guess, I mean, how does that work for many non-commercial stations? The amount of money they take in might not scale with the number of listeners they have. For example, if it's funded by a college and they have a set budget, so how would you deal with those kind of stations?
I think that's a very good
point. No, I have another point I want to make.
I think that's a difficult question, because I think we all do recognize that non-commercial stations are different than commercial stations. They don't have a profit motive. I mean, we're much more focused on the larger commercial entities, and I think, you know, we've sat down with some of the college organizations to work out a deal with them, and I think what's happened is that no one came forward originally. I mean, this law was passed, took effect October of 98. Nobody came forward and said, hey, let's do a deal. I think all of a sudden the CARP came out in February, and then people got furiously busy. And I think clearly, you know, from the copyright owner standpoint, okay, let's get the big guys done and the small and the commercial webcasters done, and then we'll migrate. There was an NPR deal done for CTV and NPR stations. They're already, you know, they have a private deal. I think that we will end up with a deal with non-commercial community stations and college stations, similar.
Ken Station falls in a very unique spot because the bill that went to Congress that almost got passed kind of ignored people like hobbyists and non-commercials because the vast majority of them would fall under the $500 a year minimum. To be a hobbyist to pay $10 a week for your hobby is not, for the right, you know, for this portion of it, does not seem that crazily out of line. For most non-commercial radio stations, their audiences have been small enough that they might fall under that. But what do you do for the few big audience non-commercials? If Ken's audience grows to thousands of people, is $200 a year flat forever a fair amount? That's just hasn't been addressed yet because Sessenbrenner, the head of the House Judiciary Committee, was trying to just, in broad strokes, cover the, you know, what he could when he only had a few days to do it.
I mean, what happens if internet radio becomes a new medium, like Ken is saying, the same as FM radio? Are the rates going to be similar?
Well, let me tell you something about FM radio and about MTV and about AM radio, because again, we keep getting back to talking about legislation, and legislation is part of life, but most business is not driven by legislation. Most business is driven by commerce and give and take. And the thing that MTV did when they started and continued to do is they have people there that understood record companies, that understood artists, that understood how they could actually be useful, and therefore they had the leverage, they earned the leverage, not from charm offensives, but through actual understanding of what would break an artist. The same with the local radio stations that John was talking about. If you want record companies to build up your business, you have to figure out how to build up their business. And that way the promotion people go into the lawyer's office and say, you're going to screw up our situation. There were attempts of people at the big labels to create a competition to MTV on a number of occasions. And what happened was the promotion people went into the CEO's offices and say, hey, don't ruin our relationship with MTV. They're selling a lot of records for us. There are today cooperations between local radio stations, artists, and record companies having to do with concerts that are $1 concerts that help promote the radio station that maybe the artist loses money on because they know there's a give and take going on. The internet world today, because of the enormous explosion of wealth and the huge hype about how everybody that was pre-internet was irrelevant and we were all the horse and buggy and all these new people like, you know, were so much smarter than all of us, the pseudo.coms of the world and all that sort of a thing, you know, was such that there was zero interest in understanding how to really work with existing businesses. I did make that announcement, and I'll probably do it in future years too if it's in our interest, but I have to tell you, not a single internet radio station has come to our company with a single, they all sent us letters, this is so great, you're so great, wait till you see what we do for you. I'm talking zero in terms of taking one of our artists in one market, in one genre, in anything, and saying, how do we create a success story? The reason MTV got the leverage with the record companies is that they figured out how to build business for the record companies, and then the record companies were beholden to them to build their business. That had nothing to do with legislation or race. That had to do with commerce being mutual. And the only way you're going to get the kind of atmosphere that you really want isn't through lobbying Congress, because that takes years and years and always is a blunt instrument. It's going to be from mutuality of interest.
Right.
So, I completely agree with Danny, and we actually have been doing some stuff. We're going to do some more stuff with him, but I think if you look at music videos, for example, which is not, there is no compulsory license for music videos being streamed on the internet. You have to go get voluntary licenses. It's incredibly painful and difficult to go get those licenses, but we're now streaming over 40 million music videos a month. We, you know, reach as many people as a cable channel does in a month in terms of streaming videos. And what's happened is we had to pay in the beginning to get licenses to all those music videos. We did deals with labels to do that. Some of the labels said, we're never giving you our music videos. We said, fine, we'll take the people who do want to give to us and we'll pay them for it. And over time, all the labels have realized the promotional value, so then we stream a video now, we will stream, you know, for one artist, we'll do over a million streams in a day. Now that's a very serious impact on that artist and their record sales, you know, more than they're getting for that video many other places. And so as a result of that, we're not paying for those videos anymore. We're still paying for the catalog videos, again, to my point about that, but we are a really valuable part of the promotional tool for these labels on the video side. I agree, we're not there yet on the webcast side, partially because the audience isn't there, but partially because it's very expensive on radio to get there. So part of what Danny wants us to do, I completely agree with, but the scale we need in order to have the impact that John says we don't have at the moment is going to be incredibly costly while we're getting to that scale where we actually matter. So
is Danny's charge of hubris on the webcasters, is that a good charge? Is that correct?
I think there's been problems on both sides. I'm not going to say that everyone on every side has been perfect angels. I'm not going to disagree with him about that. I don't think that that's the issue going forward. I mean, I think whatever's happened in the past has happened in the past, and I think people have to look at this as sort of like, all right, everybody has to sort of figure out how we can make this work together, not adversarial.
Forgetting about negativity, the thing that's interesting is to look at historically what worked positively. And I'm just telling you that you want to look at how MTV built their relationships with artists and the labels, and the way they, the time they took to create a dialogue is why they were able to create, in my opinion, what they created. And certain local radio stations, at the beginning of FM, when BCN was starting in Boston and KCN in San Francisco, the relationships they had with artists and that dynamic, Rolling Stone when it started, the relationship they had with artists, and of course Rolling Stone's worth a lot more money than some of the little record companies of the artists they were writing about, or some of the artists they were writing about, that there was a different tone to it, and those are models that can be very useful in terms of what the tone and the dialogue needs to be to go forward if everybody's going to win.
But the problem with the models that you're talking about is that they rely on scarcity of spectrum. There was only one MTV, it had national distribution. Within FM, the FM or the AM band, there's a finite number of radio stations. That's not true on the web. On the web, there's potentially an infinite number of radio stations, and that might be contrary to what the record companies want. The record companies probably would like to have fewer players, because then they can work with the fewer players to do what they want to do, which is sell records.
That's completely untrue, because of the diversity of genres, more is better for record companies and for artists, because you need diversity in order to serve the diverse different tastes of the people and the diverse artists. It is different, but the fact is that there's ways of cooperating and there's ways of not even trying.
Would you prefer to have
diversity? We're going to open up for questions in a second as well.
Would you prefer to have 5 radio stations in a given city to deal with, or 500?
500. Easy.
Do we have questions? Do we have, you want to jump in, then we're going to ask some questions.
I just wanted to make one point in the defense of webcasters. I agree that with Dan, they have not done they're most, at least of the smaller commercial webcasters, and I'll bet the bigger ones, I'll bet you did, are music fans, and would like to, they have in their hearts an interest in promoting the genre or genres of music they're playing. But in their dealings their dealings on the royalty rate issue, their contact person was a guy named Steve Marks at the RIAA. We have an internet radio station ourselves with our interns program called Panels of Music, and I think we investigated that a little bit. And Steve wasn't interested in talking about promotional opportunity.
Hey, listen, I'm not even a member of the RIAA, okay? I'm the biggest independent label in the United States. This will be our third year in a row. We're perfectly high profile, easy to find in the phone book, and no one ever called me from any webcaster about this, and we're not even in the RIAA.
But
the RIAA doesn't speak for our company. No one cares about that, though, because it's all being done. It's the same thing on the webcaster side as on the record company side. You have people who think their organs are so big that they only want to deal with other people with big organs. And let me tell you something. You know, there's been no outreach to independent labels.
And I think that's learning the business. You don't go to the RIAA to get to the promotion people at record label. You go to those labels.
And you break one act in one market on one independent label, and all the record companies will beat a path to your door. You know, that's how radio stations and record and MTV got power, was that they did something that made them valuable. That's how Rolling Stone got their power. You know, you do something that makes you valuable by figuring it out with the people that have a mutual interest, and everybody suddenly talks in a very different tone of voice, as opposed to, we're the wave of the future, do what we say because people can get it for free anyway, try to stop us, ha ha ha.
For how many decades did it take FM to start breaking artists? It was around for 30 years before anybody paid any attention to it.
So one guy, Tom Donahue in San Francisco, figured out what to do on an FM station.
And that was 30 years after the first FM radio station was developed. RCA tried to squash FM for as long as it could, because it faced competition from it. It was 30 years after FM was developed that it started having the potential that you're describing.
Okay.
Could we have a couple of years for webcasting?
Now that we're all in agreement, we're... are there questions from the audience? We definitely want to get voices in. We'll start over here.
Yeah, I have a question. You guys, it's all well and good talking about really big companies that have lots of staff and people that have time to go and negotiate with the individual independent labels and have people that work full time that's like WFMU that can go in and set up deals like that. A lot of college radio stations simply don't have the personnel or the time to figure out things like that. And make matters worse, if you follow up the letter of the law, college radio stations and all radio stations have to report like an insane number of facts about each and every recording that's played, including like the spine number, the barcode,
right.
Which make it virtually impossible for small college radio stations to follow the line.
This is a very good point, the idea of record keeping, one we haven't touched on yet, and actually they haven't been decided yet what these rules are going to be. I think the question actually is probably best answered by John, who has to deal with the data. All this data that's collected by college webcasters is going to have to go to John's organization. What do you need? What are your needs?
Yeah, again, we're just trying to distribute these royalties accurately, from the royalties that we get from it. So we're trying to get as much data as we can. We're obviously learning, that a lot of college stations are on the fly. They don't have full-time employees. They have no full-time employees. They have an advisor. They have very little budget, whatever it is. So we're trying to work, and we've talked to a lot of people about this. The number of fields has come down dramatically. We're trying to get to a reasonable amount of data so that we can identify people. I mean, that's really the bottom line. We've talked about maybe having 5 college radio stations be picked each year, give them special software so they can learn how to do essentially what's being done in the commercial world, and working with them, and us helping sort of underwrite that, or getting a company to underwrite it, figuring that if you go into the commercial world, well, that's the software you'll take with you, because you'll know how to use it, that will in fact fill out the reports that we need. So we're trying to explore that. We've sat down with a bunch of representatives of college, larger organizations, there are many college radio stations, and frankly, we've been a little frustrated, and that when we've asked them for a proposal, help us figure this out. We could go to CMJ perhaps and use that as a proxy for what college radio plays. That's not going to be, perfect, but it may be better than trying to figure out 500 college stations where they're right now filling out a playlist, in pencil. I mean, we know that you do send certain playlist reports to BMI and ASCAP for your over-the-air use. Maybe we can work with them at coming up again with a unified way of getting data so that we can piggyback on what they're already getting.
Okay. So after the panel, everyone come up and talk to John.
It's not mandatory. The reporting with ASCAP and BMI is not mandatory. I don't think it should be mandatory here either for small college stations.
Some more questions? So go ahead.
Yes. Mr. Goldberg, one thing that you mentioned was that Danny Goldberg, is that radio needs to help the industry build artists, and maybe that's why you need funding from them. And then Mr. Simpson, you said, I guess you need a target audience, something where you can promote, and with webcasting, it's so diverse, it's hard to say, okay, well, this area is doing well with this artist, let's send them there and make money through marketing. But with webcasting, it's all over the place, so it's hard to target and really, reap the benefits. So what kind of threat does satellite radio present, and could they have the same rules as webcasting, since satellite is international as webcasting is?
The rules for satellite radio will be the same. I mean, they are covered by the same provisions, and I mean, there's an ongoing negotiation right now between XM Sirius and XM Exchange. So, I mean, they will be governed by the same rules.
I don't think that radio stations need to do it. I just think that it works better when people work together and are helping each other instead of arguing with each other. And that there are certainly ways. Just because internet radio is not geographically localized doesn't mean that it's not very valuable to artists. That's my whole reason for wanting to work more with the stations. One of the things that internet radio can do is play genres which are too small in any locality, but on a national or a worldwide basis can be very meaningful. Something like blues, for example. There's not going to be a commercial blues station in our lifetime, but on a worldwide basis, an internet blues station can have an incredibly important audience to an artist like Jimmy Vaughan, who I release, where I could never expect a commercial radio station to put it out. So I think that there's going to be a lot of ways, if there was goodwill and the commitment that it was part of the business interest, especially of the bigger commercial webcasters who have some staff available and resources for this, to figure out a mutuality. I don't think just the geographic location is the only way that you cluster people and sell them music. In fact, genre is often a much more intense clustering, even though it's dispersed all over the world.
Excellent. Some more questions back in the audience. Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to ask, like, you guys all seem very confident that there's going to be kind of station made soon, the non-commercial stations, and they're going to be able to absolutely control the royalties. But, I mean, in the meantime, we're paying lots and lots of money. That's really impacting our budget. I'm just wondering what you feel the timetable is on all this. Like, you're trying to, like, get some startup funds to get together and,
Well, hopefully you haven't been forced to pay anything yet. I mean, for one thing, if you have fewer than 17 and a half listeners on average, that takes into account the middle of a night, the middle of the summer, you know, per 17 and a half average listeners per hour throughout the year, you only have to pay the $500 minimum. And after Jesse Helms torpedoed the Small Webcasters Amendment Act, I think John Simpson agreed to just keep things on hold until it gets to come up to Congress again.
And our so preference continues to be free.
Right. So, I mean, that sounds like an interesting question. I guess the answer is that from the panelists, you know, there isn't that big of a rush or a hurry today to worry about the royalties. Is that correct?
Well, I think I mentioned that it seemed like all of a sudden in February of this year when the librarians, the recommendation of the panel went to the librarian, all of a sudden this serious activity started. I think it's going to continue until there is a global deal in place, and I see it within the next 6 months. So, I think that's what we're probably looking at.
Okay.
Well, with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting deal, there is already, for smaller NPR stations with less than 10 paid staff, they don't have to report, and they pay a flat rate, or CDP pays that. So I don't understand why that can't be used as a precedent for college radio. And right now, my station has to pay $2,500 in back royalties, and with that, our voters said we have to pay it. So that comes out of our budget. So what do we do now? Well, our budgets are being, the average budget for a college radio station is about $9,500. So why can't we get an exemption like the small webcasters did?
Well, it's not an exemption.
Something for us.
That's a very separate deal, and those stations may retain far more. The one thing that you should know is that they do report if they have side channels. So we are getting full, complete reporting from any side channel. So an NPR station that has, let's say a blues channel, or they have a talk channel, and they have something else, will be reporting to us everything they're using, other than on the simulcast. They don't report for their simulcast, but they would report if they have other side channels.
But what kind of college radio stations have?
Well, you may not. And again, we're trying to work with college radio to figure out what makes sense so that we can pay the royalties to the right people.
Well, and this is the reason Jesse Helms got involved, because you can deal with the non-commercial radio stations.
I disagree with that. I mean, Jesse Helms' motivation.
I don't understand.
We're not. We've been waiting, actually, for a proposal.
Organization, like we're a bunch of different college radio.
Well, IBS and CBI, are they? We've heard from them. We've never really seen a proposal from them, but we've heard from them.
I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
Excellent. Another question all the way in the back over there.
What role do you think that if an artist or unsigned artist will play in this, how can fair affect them? Because a lot of them use webcasting
to get the music because you can use it for don't play them. So how is this going to affect them when these stations are, they can't afford to pay these royalties as it is, and then they have to start cutting what they can play? It actually benefit the independent artists. If you're giving it to them for a lesser price, if you're giving it to them for free or even for 50% of the rate or whatever deal you make, you're going to get more play. So it may, in fact, benefit independent artists who are willing to do that. Now, I think what you have to recognize, when you do a direct license, remember, the compulsory license is the easy license. You go to one place, you pay your license fees, and you're done. To go out and do what some stations have done and have to negotiate the 300 levels, it's hard for 300 artists. But the benefit to the artists, the benefit to the independent label, is that they get more control. So if you get a compulsory license, you can broadcast whatever you want. If you want to do a direct license with me, if I'm running a label and I'm going to do a direct license with you as a webcaster, I'm going to say, hey, I want to see a link to my page. I want to see a link. I want to see you have my artist bio. I want to see this, that, the other thing. Kind of what Danny was saying, I want to see real promotion if I'm going to give you a better than statutory rate. So that's, I think, where you can work with people. Again,
We're there to be, to make it easy in the sense of collecting and distributing to the mass of people. You know, most of my labels, I have the five major labels, but I also have 400 independent labels who are incredibly, I mean, from the smallest of the small to the biggest independent labels, not the biggest independent label, but although we do collect for Artemis on stuff that is collectible. There is some of my small labels, especially in satellite, like Hawaiian labels and blues labels, classical labels, had huge distributions proportionately. The majors are much further down when you get onto satellite and the web because of these niche broadcasters. I mean, and these small labels, our biggest played album was a children's record in the first distribution, and they were so glad to see that kind of revenue. It represented a huge chunk of what they bring in a year.
Ken,
so for the indies, this can be very valuable revenue.
At FMU, do you accept records from unsigned artists that you'll play? Do you have a waiver form, an agreement that you can give to them?
Yeah, we do. And also, I wanted to say regarding the waivers that WFMU has been collecting, if the global agreement is not reached that John's mentioning he's hoping for in the next 6 months, then we are going to try to see what we can do about getting a smaller group of labels that would extend waivers to all college and community radio stations.
We got time for one more question.
If I could also just make a comment, I don't know what the terms of your waiver are, but if you're an artist, this is me speaking from my old days as a manager or as an entertainment lawyer, if you're an artist or a small label and you're signing one of these waivers, make sure it's not perpetual. I've seen some webcasters do that.
Yeah, ours is not perpetual.
Yeah. I mean, it should be for a limited period of time.
All the record label has to do is give us 60 days notice and they're out.
Okay. So just make sure you see a lawyer.
Okay, and one more question.
So,
a goal.
If webcasters are dropping left and right, or non-commercial webcasters are dropping left and right, how is that going to allow for helping to build this promotional relationship that labels want to have with webcasters if they can't even stay in business long enough to get in touch with the guys?
Well, I mean, first of all, the statute took effect in October of 98. People have had 4 years to start that dialogue. And I think it's kind of interesting to say, oh, we didn't know we were supposed to be talking. We didn't know we were supposed to be doing this. So, you know, again, there's been many people were even online before 1998 in October. Obviously, that's when this law took effect. But there's been plenty of time.
So, I think we have to wrap up now, but there are a couple of interesting things. First, at 3 o'clock today, Kurt's going to be giving a talk shop on how internet radio will replace AM and FM and probably can answer lots of these questions. In addition, if you're a college radio station and looking for more information on this, you should probably contact either IBS or CBI or one of the other organizations that's basically organizing and working with college radio stations, or talk to these panelists and ask your questions afterwards and really get in touch. The more that you talk with them and the more that you understand the issue, the better it's going to be for everyone. So I just want to say thank you to CMJ for this and thank you.
I was.
I'm not sure how to do it.